This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
This podcast brought to you by My Patriot Supply. Did you miss the chance to get a 72-hour emergency food supply with free shipping for just $10? What's wrong with you? Don't worry. Call 888-411-7440 right now. They have a few left, and they're selling out fast. 888-411-7440. What are you waiting for? A disaster? Do it right now. 888-411-7440.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Let's get right into it. It's time for a Buck Brief.
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
Vladimir Putin is calling it a stab in the back. Turkey has shot down a Russian Sukhoi Su-24 warplane near the Syrian-Turkish border. The Russian jet had apparently violated Turkish airspace. It ignored numerous warnings over the course of a few minutes, and the Russians lost their plane. Russians lost their plane, and one of their fighters is confirmed dead. One of their pilots is confirmed dead. Another one may be in rebel hands currently. There are conflicting reports on that. The jet crashed in Syria's Turkmen Mountains, and we need to turn off the music on the Buck Brief there, if we could, please. Thank you. So there's one pilot dead, and the other one is reportedly captured by Turkmen. And that's according to the Daily Mail just now. This is the situation. This is the scenario that many of us have been warning about for weeks. This is part of the series of complications of having foreign powers, including regional and perhaps you could say in the case of Russia, hemispheric, not necessarily global powers quite yet, involved in what is a civil war, a sectarian war, a jihad, all of the above. There have been concerns for quite some time that because of what has been dubbed a crowded airspace over Syria in the midst of this civil war, that at some point there would be a miscalculation and somebody somewhere would shoot down a plane belonging to a country that has the sort of air force or the sort of military power to respond in a way that changes the balance of things here. Now, I don't subscribe to the domino effect in this case. I don't see this necessarily spiraling much further out of control than it already is. I don't think that the Russians view Syria, for example, as sacred soil for them. This is not a place where they're willing to pay any price. This is an ally. They are trying to assist their ally in Assad in Syria. And Russia's relationship with Turkey, as many of you I'm sure know from your history, is a complicated one. In fact, at various points, the greatest threat to the Ottomans, or rather the greatest threat to the Russians, depending on how you want to put it, was the Ottoman Empire and vice versa. The Ottomans and the Russians fought a series of conflicts against each other. This stretches back to Peter the Great, and even before that, the Ottomans and the Russians have been in each other's throats. That's both an issue of civilizations clashing, but also just of geography. You look at the Ottomans, you look at the Black Sea, you look at the geographic positioning of what's now Turkey. And you look at Russia and the former Soviet Union, and before that, the various principalities of Muscovy. And you look at this and you say, oh, okay, well, that's why they've been fighting for a long time. So there's a long history of animosity, actually, between the Russians and the Turks as entities. And this is certainly not going to help things at all. Putin is very upset about this. Putin says that there will be serious consequences. What will those consequences be? Well, that obviously remains to be seen. I can tell you that this will certainly increase some of the Russian airstrikes, but the Russians have already been going after those on the ground. They've already been going after ISIS and the rebels pretty hard. But keep in mind that it wasn't just this plane that was shot down. There was also a search and rescue helicopter deployed that was reportedly shot down with a U.S.-provided TOW missile, usually used as an anti-armor missile that can take out tanks, armored personnel carriers, and it blew a helicopter out of the sky. So that's another aircraft that Russia has lost. And in this case, the weapon came from the U.S. And we're being told that it wasn't ISIS that shot down that helicopter. It was rebels. It was the Turkmen. Now, the Turkmen of Syria are ethnically connected to the Turks. There is some sense of an ethnic solidarity there. And there are actually Turkmen in Iraq as well. They're one of these people, sort of like the Kurds, that are spread over a pretty wide area of the Middle East. And they had been bombed. They had been bombed by Russia's planes, Russia's air force in recent weeks. And so it seems that they were the ones who shot up the Russian pilots of the Su-24 aircraft that Turkey shot down. So Turkey shoots down a Russian Su-24 using heat-seeking missiles. And then there are individuals who have parachuted out of that plane. And as they were coming down to ground, the Turkmen opened fire and killed them. In fact, there are some video of this as well, where you have Syrian rebels chanting Allahu Akbar over the body of this fallen Russian pilot. Play clip four. They're yelling Takbir and Allahu Akbar when they have the body of this pilot. And of course, there's that video of it. So this is going to be replayed in news outlets around the world. The Russians are certainly going to see this, and there will be a sense of rage. Now, what you're also seeing play out is that all of the different entities involved in Syria have their own parochial sets of interest in some ways, their own very specific sets of interest, right? Turkey is not devoted to the anti-Assad fight, really. And Turkey has its eyes constantly on the Kurds. Turkey will launch airstrikes. We think to ourselves, oh, well, that's great. They'll launch airstrikes against the Islamic State. But we find out they'll launch airstrikes against the PKK. They'll launch airstrikes against the Kurdish separatist groups that have been useful in the fight against the Islamic State. You see what Russia's been doing. Russia will launch airstrikes, but some of them will be against ISIS, but many of them are against rebels. They're against other groups on the ground that are anti-ISIS in nature, but are certainly not, are in some cases backed by U.S. forces and or U.S. materiel, I should say, and have in very small doses, a few of them maybe have received some U.S. training, although that all depends. The training program, as we've been told, is an utter disaster. So you have this incident that's been warned about for weeks. Now we will see what happens here. What I meant about how Syria is not sacred ground is compare this for Russians, of course, is compare this for a second to a similar incident that could occur, say, in or around the Balkans. There I would be really worried. There I would have a moment of this could really get out of control very quickly. I think for the Russians, the situation in Syria is in some sense contained for them, meaning their involvement is only going to go to a certain level. The Russians are not going to occupy Syria. The Russians are not going to put huge numbers of troops on the ground in Syria. And they could walk away from Syria if they had to without it being catastrophic for them. But if something were to happen in the Balkans, Russian pride, Russian history, and of course the NATO alliance that would be automatically called into question if there were, say, a shoot down of any NATO craft, or if there were any exchange of fire in that region between Russian forces and NATO forces, you could have something that gets much worse. So I'm not as concerned about this turning into a massive conflagration beyond what it already is. It's already many powers involved. You've got, they don't even really keep a body count anymore. I mean, you keep hearing it's 250,000. Well, it's been 250,000 for the last 6 months. So I assume it's gone up substantially from that. But this is not, in my mind, going to lead to anything beyond what Russia's already doing. You'll see Putin most likely double down with the airstrikes. They're already providing artillery support on the ground. I think you'll see Russian Spetsnaz going after some HVTs. Perhaps they'll be operating under the guise of being Assad forces on the ground, and they'll go do some raids and other special operations type activity. But this isn't the big one, so to speak. I don't see anything necessarily spiraling, again, even further out of control than what we already have here. I know there's an emergency meeting of NATO, and or there's an emergency meeting of allies, and Turkey's obviously upset about this, and Russia is saying, don't travel to Turkey right now. And the foreign minister is very upset, and we'll see where this all goes. But look, this is what's going to happen. This was, in a sense, inevitable. It was inevitable because as long as you have this many planes operating in this confined an airspace, and you've got the Russians always testing their limits. I mean, the Russians test their limits even with us. They'll fly pretty close to the coast of Alaska. They've been doing some provocative things to sort of see what they could get away with. Well, Turkey takes all this very seriously in the context of it having a border on this conflict. And they decided they were going to make an example of this Russian jet. And so they fired on it after repeated warnings. And as we see, there is a clash of wills at work here. This also, by the way, I think if you were of the mind that we weren't going to put a no-fly zone in place before, I think we're definitely not going to do it for the Obama administration is not going to do it anytime soon now. Could you imagine Russian planes coming up against American planes, coming up against Turkish planes, coming up against Assad planes and surface-to-air missiles and anti-aircraft on the ground? This is a mess. So the Obama administration, you can essentially consider them out on all this. I'm sure President Obama will call Putin. They'll hold some kind of a meeting, but this isn't going to lead anywhere. So I think the conflict continues. Obviously, tensions have been ratcheted up. There's always the possibility of further escalation. All of that holds true. But I think for now, you'll see a lot of tough talk from some of the parties involved here, particularly the Russian government and Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister. I don't know if you're going to see that much of an increase in action, though. We'll have to wait and see. Sponsor this half hour is Superbeet. Steenbuck, are you looking for a natural energy boost that's actually good for your heart? The answer is Superbeets. Now, Superbeets are made from the highest quality beets that are loaded with dietary nitrates. Dietary nitrates convert to nitric oxide in the body. We're going to go through a little bit of the science here. And that's been shown to help boost circulation, relax arteries, and maintain healthy blood pressure levels. Superbeets is better than just beets because it's protected by a patented drying process, which is also the secret to its amazing berry taste. Plus, it's all natural, so I get lasting energy and don't crash a few hours after drinking it. I love that I have amazing energy for my workouts, and I'm doing something healthy for my heart and blood pressure. So please, call 800-311-4367 or go to teambuckbeats.com. You get a 30-day supply of Superbeets for free. Comes with your first order. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. You'll also receive a free book, Beat the Odds, and free shipping on your whole order. So you're going to love the results you feel, and this is on your first free canister, which is guaranteed, or else you get your money back. No risk to you at all here. Call 800-311-4367 or go to teambuckbeats.com. Back in a minute.
Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network.
This podcast brought to you by My Patriot Supply. Did you miss the chance to get a 72-hour emergency food supply with free shipping for just $10? What's wrong with you? Don't worry. Call 888-411-7440 right now. They have a few left, and they're selling out fast. 888-411-7440. What are you waiting for? A disaster? Do it right now. 888-411-7440.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show.
Everybody can relax. John Kerry says that we don't have to worry about anything. ISIS will not be defeated. They're not 10 feet tall. Play clip one.
I believe ISIS is going to be defeated. ISIS is not 10 feet tall. I have absolute confidence that as we increase what we are doing today, as there is more focus, I'm just in Abu Dhabi now. We've just had serious meetings here. I'm about to meet with the Saudi Arabians. There is a very clear focus by everybody. There is a united front, and I am absolutely convinced that Daesh will be defeated, and there will be increased steps taken in order to do so. And what we need to do is not succumb to fear.
I was with him, I guess, until the whole using the Arabic acronym Daesh. So what are you doing, dude? Come on. Come on, buddy. No, I wasn't with him at all. It's all nonsense. They've had 4 years. They've pulled nothing together. Oh, you're in Abu Dhabi? Ooh, they're really going to do a lot. The United Arab Emirates? Yeah, they're going to wage ceaseless war against the Islamic State. Because there's no support among that population at all for Sunni Arab jihadist insurgencies. It's not like there's anybody from within the UAE who's ever sent money to any of these guys, or maybe still is, and that would be crazy. Yeah, the UAE, they're going to get it all done. Sure, they've bought some very fancy planes from us. They don't particularly like to use them against anybody who screams Allahu Akbar and wages jihad. Just putting that out there. But yeah, sure. This coalition of 60-plus nations, that's going to get it done. And if that doesn't convince you, by the way, if that doesn't make you feel better, we have Fred Lucas, who is the Blaze's White House correspondent, who I see here has said that Obama is at the White House. Obama says climate conference in Paris will be a, quote, powerful rebuke to the terrorists, end quote. I don't know if this is if this could be parody or if this is an Onion article, because I have a hard time believing the president would say something so very bizarre and stupid. But no, actually, he could say this. Whether he said it or not, he definitely could. It looks like he did. Yeah, a climate change conference in Paris. That's going to be a powerful rebuke to these terrorists. That's going to make them really worried. Because if we can prevent the global temperature from rising 1 degree Celsius over the next 100 years, the terrorists have lost. I don't know. It's sometimes you reach this point where you're trying to analyze something, you're trying to come up with commentary, trying to pull something, and you say to yourself, this is just so absurd. This is farcical. This is nonsense. It's like being told to read nursery rhymes backwards and then explain their relevance to the Constitution or something. I don't know how you do that. Powerful rebuke to the terrorists? So the president really says? John Kerry says there's a united front against ISIS? Really? How united is that front right now? You got the Russians who are, by the way, going to say that Turkey's providing cover for the Islamic State. That's going to be their line. You can imagine what that's going to do for relations there. And the Russian public is going to see this and say, oh, okay, so a NATO country, Turkey, can blow a Russian plane out of the sky. The Russian plane was not a threat to Turkish aircraft. It was not dropping bombs or shooting at anybody, and yet they blew it out of the sky. And then the pilots, who were effectively defenseless while parachuting down, were shot up by rebels supported, or at least reportedly supported, by the United States, Turkmen rebels in the mountains. So, yeah, this all looks really bad. But this White House is much more concerned right now with a climate change conference in Paris than anything else. Oh, I know what would be said. No, Buck, you don't understand. It's because they're holding the meeting in Paris. That's supposed to be the rebuke, the fact that they're not afraid. No, I think they also believe that the climate change talk shows the international community coming together and speaking with one voice, and that multilateral, cosmopolitanist, internationalist institutions are what's going to defeat the Islamic State, not, you know, a Marine Expeditionary Unit, 101st Airborne, U.S. Special Operators. That's not what the Obama administration thinks is going to get it done. In this case, it's going to be basically UN meetings.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, our phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. Today, the shootdown of a Russian plane by Turkish fighters near the Turkish border over Turkish airspace. And now people are wondering where all this is going to lead. We have Mark in Maryland who wants to talk about it. Mark, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, Buck. You know, if cooler heads prevail, we could end up into a semi-Cold War situation here. But if we get a bunch of hotheads going, we could go into a full-fledged World War. What are your thoughts on it?
You're asking me, I think my audio cut out there a second. You're asking me if we're in World War III or if this could turn into World War III?
It could possibly turn into a World War III if hotheads prevail.
Right. Well, I hate to lean on the cliche for analytic purposes of anything can happen, but I will put that proviso out there. Let me first say this, though. When you start to make comparisons to world wars, I mean, even just think about World War I, for example, which was sparked by the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand by Serbian separatists. And you look at the numbers that were mobilized in that case, and you're talking about armies of literally millions that were unleashed on each other across Europe and beyond, and casualty rates that were absolutely staggering. According to PBS here, I've got this. I pulled this up because I had a feeling this might come up today during the show. You have from the First World War, Russian casualties, 9 million. British Empire, 3 million. France, 6 million. Italy, 2 million. So when you start talking about world wars, let's keep it all into some perspective in that could that happen? It could happen, but are we anywhere near what we would consider a world war? Right now, no, we are not. What's going on in Syria is a sectarian civil war, and you have 250,000 dead inside of Syria's borders, and you have some transnational terrorism, and you have jihad going on, all that. But when you start to look at it, go back and read some of the accounts of battles in the First World War, in the Second World War, go back and read about Stalingrad, and you'll say to yourself, okay, well, we are at a tiny fraction in terms of the men at arms as well as the overall casualties in Syria as you were in those two contexts. I mean, is it possible? It's possible, but you'd have to ask yourself why. Why would Russia want to risk severe casualties or a much greater involvement here than it? Remember, it's different with the Soviet Empire. They viewed Afghanistan as part of a piece of getting towards of moving towards the Indian Ocean and becoming a true global power. Right. There was a sort of great game theory behind the Soviet Union's moves in Afghanistan. Syria, yeah, they like having the base at Tartus and Syria as an ally, but I don't think that they're, and I also think they feel like they probably learned some lessons from Afghanistan, but then again, who knows? There were, you know, the Russian leadership maybe thought that they could have won that if it was just a little different. It is troubling, though, when you have U.S. munitions used to shoot down Russian aircraft, even though that's not why we gave it to the rebels. You got to see it from the Russian perspective for a second. It starts to feel a little bit like some of the Stinger missiles that were shooting down Hind helicopter gunships during the Soviet-Afghan war, right? Where did those Stinger missiles come from? kind of came from us. Where these TOW missiles come from in Syria? Definitely came from us. So this is not going to ratchet down tensions, Mark. I can promise you that.
Okay.
All right. That is an answer. Thank you, sir, for calling in. Good to talk to you. So we'll keep an eye on this. By the way, while all this is happening, while the shootdown's happening, there is a global alert for U.S. citizens who will be traveling pretty much anywhere. That's the status of things right now. The State Department has said, hey, just so you know, you could in fact find yourself under threat from terrorism if you're traveling abroad right now. So just be aware. This is not really helpful. This reminds me of, why don't we just bring back sort of orange and yellow and chartreuse and all the different color systems for a terror alert? What are we supposed to do? We're really not going to travel. I know it's just a warning. What are they warning us about? You know, I hope you don't pick the wrong plane to fly on. I don't really know what a State Department global terrorism warning is really supposed to indicate. Other than the fact that Al-Qaeda is not on the ropes and jihad is still very much alive. And I think we should start to feel much more, well, some of us have been very critical of the Obama administration's policies with regard to all of this disastrous stuff happening in the Middle East for quite some time. But now, this is a real vulnerability. It's not just a vulnerability, I think, for Obama's legacy. I do think it's also a vulnerability for Hillary Clinton, too. She was Secretary of State under Obama's first term, and she's going to have to own this foreign policy to some degree, not just as a Democrat, but as a former senior administration official who was responsible for U.S. foreign policy in the region. It's going to be a big problem. She's going to have a big problem here with this. Because the whole region is an absolute mess. And as much as they're trying to push forward our allegiances, our allies, as being right alongside us, what exactly are they doing? They're sending some money here and there, a couple of airstrikes, a couple of token strikes from countries that have fancy planes that we sold them. It's about it. You're noticing there aren't huge brigades of Saudis signing up to go do patrols and police and provide population security for parts of Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, in Paris, by the way, they found another suicide vest. They think that this one was abandoned by Abdeslam, who's supposed to be one of the masterminds of this whole thing. His vest either didn't work or he just decided, you know what? I'm going to take a temporary pass, at least, on this whole martyrdom thing. This is part of why there's such an urgency right now in Belgium, which is still under a state of emergency, and there's still tensions are very high there right now, because they know that at least one guy who was directly involved in all this stuff going on, all these terror attacks and the aftermath, and they're looking for him in the raids, and there's one guy who's out there who was directly tied to all this, and somehow he's been able to evade authorities up to this point in time. So there's still, right now, a terrorist for sure on the loose in Europe somewhere. It's probably, my guess is he's trying to make his way to Turkey and then into Syria, and he may have somehow figured out an escape route to do that. There was a lot of planning that went into what happened in Paris, as we know. It also means there were supposed to be eight suicide bombers. Keep that in mind. Eight suicide bombers were on the loose in Paris. I mean, this was a huge attack. And I know it's early on in the aftermath of this to be thinking in even more macabre terms. I mean, this is even more, it's harder to think about. I think the attack could have actually had even more casualties. I think that in a sense, there were a few things that went a certain way that prevented there from being even higher numbers. Now, I know it was a mass casualty attack, 130 killed and hundreds more wounded. But when you look at some of the possibilities here, based on their target selection, they actually could have killed a lot more people. And the French security response, to me, also seemed surprisingly slow and inept, particularly in the case of the shootout at Bataclan. I suppose they thought that inside that theater they're dealing with a hostage situation, but to those of us who were just following it even via various news outlets and wires and social media as it was breaking, it seemed very clear that it was not a hostage situation. It was a mass execution. So this could have been worse. And I know you can say that about pretty much any attack, but in many cases, it's very true. It was true on 9/11 with the plane that was taken down in that field in Pennsylvania. That plane was going for the Capitol building, and we all know it. Or maybe the White House, maybe they would have changed at the last minute, who knows. But it was heading for a major U.S. facility. So even on a day as horrific as 9/11, in a sense, because of the brave actions of a few, even greater casualties were avoided. And I think when you look at what happened in Paris, there were a lot of things that went wrong, and there were a lot of casualties, but it could have been even worse. And I think that's important to keep in mind when we think about what we're dealing with here, and also how urgent it really is that we try to put everything in place that's possible to prevent an attack like this, or to very quickly mitigate any casualties, stamp it out, and kill those you-know-whats before they can kill any of us. That's got to be the mentality. There's some other countries that have that mentality. Israel has that mentality, and that's why their casualties in these sorts of attacks tend to be on the lower side, because they've learned from long, hard experience. You better be ready. You better be ready. And the French and the Belgians and the rest of Europe, I think, look at this situation, and hopefully they're at least asking the right questions. What could we have done differently? What can we do better? And also, what really is the future of this multicultural project that we're undergoing right now in Europe? How do we assimilate immigrants in such a way that even second or third generation immigrants don't decide to wage war against the state that has provided very generously for them, despite all of the complaints about discrimination and marginalization and victimology that we hear? How can they do that, too? That's a part of this. That's a part of the counter-radicalization that needs attention right now. All right. Take a break here. 888-900-3393 if you want to call in. Team, we got more coming up. I'll be right back.
You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Phone lines are open, 888-900-3393. We have Jim in Cincinnati. Jim, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck, how's it going? Hey,
good, sir. How are you?
Throw my analysis past you of this situation real fast. I agree with you when you say that, you know, Russia's not do or die in Syria. Obviously, Syria's not that important to them, and Russia's not going to take on NATO over, you know, one plane in Syria. But Syria is like a messy three-way proxy war already with all these alliances so screwed up. I think Russia is really going to push hard to escalate this proxy war even more than it already has been, because Putin can't lose face. He's an autocrat. His entire existence is based upon the Russian people thinking that he is Donald Trump on steroids. So he can't let Turkey push Russia around, or, you know, he might not be president of Russia forever. Does that make sense?
No, I think you're correct. I would agree with you that this is going to be an escalation in the proxy war, at least in the Russian side of things. Keep in mind, if people think of, you know, the Russian military, and we sort of have this notion of, oh, well, Soviet Union, global power. Russia still has a pretty decent punch when it comes to its military capabilities. But Turkey's actually no slouch either. Turkey has a very large military of its own. So this is not a situation. This is not like Ukraine, where Russia can just essentially come. Because remember, Ukraine was essentially defanged. It had fangs. It had nukes, a lot of them. And we said, hey, Ukraine, we got your back. Don't worry about it. Between us, the Brits, and Russia, believe it or not, you know, they had the Budapest memorandum. We'll make sure you guys are fine. The Ukrainian military was not in any shape to resist an insurgency in its east with a substantial amount of Russian direct assistance and even kinetic activity. I mean, they were blowing stuff up on behalf of the separatists. It's a different story. Ukraine. If the Russians, you know, the Russians can't just get into it with Turkey to no effect. Turkey's got a big military.
Bringing up Ukraine is what I was going to say that does worry me, though. if we all start throwing shadow punches at each other because we're in this big proxy war trying to decide who's going to control the Middle East, that could really quickly end up being, you know, Russia starts trying to redirect towards the Balkans and, you know, somebody gets shot down over Alaska and, you know, you start getting a more belligerent Russia because they're starting to lose face because we're throwing punches back in the Middle East. That's when things could really get out of hand.
Yeah, there are many scenarios where there's the possibility of what you would call miscalculation, right? Where somebody thinks something's going to happen, it doesn't happen that way, and then they respond perhaps even more aggressively than had been anticipated. And that's a way for things to get really bad really quickly. But the key point here is that Syria is not Ukraine, and it's certainly not the Balkans. Syria is not a place that Russia is going to fall on its sword defending entirely. That said, I do think that Putin's going to come out and try to make an example of, I mean, the way to do it here would be to go after that Turkmen minority really hard for a little while and really light them up and just say, what do you mean we're blowing up ISIS? These guys are ISIS. Assad says they're ISIS, and he's the legitimate. Remember, Russia plays this game. There's some similarity here. Russia said this about the ousted premier in Kiev when there was the initial Maidan revolution. They're like, that was a legitimate government, right? Technically speaking, they have an argument. And the same thing could be said about Assad. Assad is the legitimate recognized government, or has been the legitimate recognized government of Syria, and they're saying we back them against all these terrorists. If the terrorists happen to be Turkmen, oops, too bad. And I think the Russians don't mess around, and they have a long memory on this stuff.
None of this is at all clear cut. There's reports from the DOD that Glenn was talking about this morning about how we wanted ISIS and all this stuff. Russia has plenty of leg to stand on if they want to start escalating this. And I think they will, to a point.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think they'll do it in a way. Look, they can do it without risking too much in the way of Russian troops. But keep in mind, I think you already saw a Russian plane blown out of the sky with hundreds of Russians on board. You're going to see a replay. We're so worried about ISIS hitting us here. You might see a replay, you know, heaven forbid, but I would be very concerned about this if I were the FSB, of the Moscow theater siege or Beslan or one of the huge jihadist attacks against Russia. I'm sure that's being plotted right now.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. I wanted to clarify something as we're looking at this breaking news about the Russian plane that has been shot down by Turkish jets. That much we know for sure. The Russian plane violated Turkish airspace and received repeated warnings, and then the Turks shot it down. But as to what happened to those pilots, you have a wide variety of reports as to what the situation is. You have one, you had a leader of a rebel group on the ground who said that they fired up into the air and killed the pilots, presumably as they were parachuting down. You have another one saying, a spokesman for the rebel group saying the pilot was already dead when he landed, and they're looking for a second pilot. You have a Turkish official, in fact, saying they're both alive, but a Turkish government official told Reuters the pilots are believed to still be alive. And yeah, so you've got a lot of conflicting stories as to what's going on here and what the reality is for those two Russian pilots who were shot down. But it is a very tense situation, to say the least, and we will see what happens after that. Now, I wanted to switch, if I could. Maybe we should start getting a sort of some intro music going for when we want to just do a hard turn into politics, because I do think that we should. People like me, for example, end up going on various shows and such to discuss the status of the Republican race, and what you'll get these days are a lot of questions about two candidates in particular. You'll get a lot of questions about Donald Trump and a lot of questions about Ben Carson. Not so much questions as requests or demands might be too strong. Requests for you, being the conservative, wherever you are, to defend the latest Trump or Carson comment. So it'll say, you know, Donald Trump said this. What do you think about that? And I can tell you that in some cases, it is becoming very hard, not just to, because, you know, I'm not on Team Trump. I'm not a Trump supporter. I haven't picked who I would vote for yet. And I don't like being in the position where I have to say, yeah, sure, whatever that candidate says, because they're technically part of the GOP race, me, this guy, as a conservative, I have to now say, oh, well, let me explain away this comment. Let me massage this verbal flub for the benefit of whatever candidate it may be, whether it's Trump or Carson. Those are usually the two that we're talking about here. As I said yesterday, I think the Carson balloon is deflating. I think that is underway. I think that's happening right now. And by the time we get to Iowa, we shall see. Latest polling I see here out of Quinnipiac University shows Trump and Cruz atop the Iowa GOP caucus. And here's some interesting stats from this. Donald Trump gets 25% of Iowa likely Republican caucus participants in a too close to call race with Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who's at 23%. Double his support from 4 weeks ago. Cruz, in a month, has doubled his Iowa support. That is big. People talk about, oh, where's the Rubio surge? Or where's the... I think we're seeing the Cruz surge right now. Cruz control. Ted Cruz went to the danger zone. And so that's something we should keep an eye on here. You also have Dr. Ben Carson at 18% and Marco Rubio at 13%. So there are some pretty interesting changes here with regard to who's where in this race. Ted Cruz is getting bumped up pretty substantially. There's also some, I'll see if I can pull out some of these stats on where people are on refugees for you. Here we go. Iowa likely Republican caucus participants oppose 81% to 15%. Allowing Syrian refugees into the U.S. and oppose 82% to 13% allowing them into Iowa. So people in Iowa apparently really don't want a bunch of Syrian refugees, and they definitely don't want them in Iowa either. So it's not unanimous, but it's over 80%. That's pretty strong, which is an interesting dynamic, and I think that's why you see you hear some of the rhetoric coming out of Trump and Carson that you do on these issues. Another thing that you're seeing is Donald Trump getting a lot of heat over comments he made, for example. There's a lot, right? I could start that sentence and where do we go from there? Getting heat for a lot of places you could point to. But he made this comment about Muslims in New Jersey celebrating in the aftermath of 9/11. And look, there were Muslims all over the world who were celebrating. That doesn't mean all Muslims all over the world were celebrating. That's not what I said. There were Muslims in many countries around the world who were, in fact, celebrating. There were non-Muslims in countries around the world who were celebrating, by the way. A dear friend of mine was in Brazil during this, and I remember she told me at the time, she said, oh, yeah, no, there were people in Brazil who were maybe not dancing, but were smiling and saying, see, America finally got what was coming to it. This was a widespread notion. Look at the polls on how many people in the Muslim world and around the world think 9/11 was an inside job. Look at the polls that show how many think somehow the Jews were involved. It's terrifying. So this notion that, it's unthinkable. Look, I'm not saying that there were Muslim Americans in New Jersey across the river who were doing this, but let's also keep in mind there definitely were a lot of people who were doing that. Maybe you could say that's a separate discussion, but I think for the purposes of putting all this into context, we should not lose sight of the fact that there were people celebrating, and there obviously were Palestinians who were dancing and celebrating. And when you look at Palestinian support for the Islamic State, by the way, for the Islamic State, it's actually pretty high. So But Hamas is totally different. Hamas is a resistance. Hamas isn't jihad. It's a resistance organization, even though it's an organization founded by the Muslim Brotherhood and engages in jihad and martyrdom and all that stuff. But anyway, I guess that's a discussion for another time. But look, Trump's comments on the Muslims, I've never seen this. I don't think it happened. If I'm wrong, let me know. Show me the video. Show me the evidence. I don't see it. Okay. That all said, it's amazing how the focus on every statement that Trump makes, the amount of research and fact-checking that goes into it, and now there is a very obvious campaign out there because they're trying to find just more and more ways to take Trump out of the race, both on the GOP side with the establishment and with the left-wing media. And they're saying that at this point, the truth for Trump doesn't matter at all. This is now an official line you're hearing from Democrats and from the left, that Trump supporters don't care about the truth at all. And what I would say to that is a lot of people don't care that much about the truth when it comes to their politician of choice. Look at all the people who voted for Barack Obama again after he lied. And yes, it was a lie about their ability to keep their health care plan. Something that you would think would be very near and dear to your heart. You get to see your doctor. You know, you get to see the person you trust when you're sick. President Obama looks you in the eye and he says, you absolutely will. We just have to pass Obamacare. Hope and change. I wouldn't lie to you. You can count on me. He's a liar. He lied for political advantage, and he did so repeatedly and intentionally, and it was willful. It was knowing. Did people care in 2012? No. They didn't care. Never mind Hillary Clinton, who I guess it's more important we look at her truthfulness or blatant lack thereof, says she came under sniper fire in Bosnia. I mean, let me tell you something. If you're somebody who's come under real sniper fire or real mortar fire or something, gonna think that's something you'd really remember. First time you're in a red zone and all of a sudden someone starts lighting up a 240 Gulf next to your head, for example, because they think they see something on the ground, or you remember that. That's not something that just sort of fades back into your memory. Oh, I don't remember. Was I worried for a second that we were in the middle of a gunfight? Because I don't really know. You don't know. Trust me. You remember that. But Hillary said that she came under sniper fire. It was just a lie to make herself seem more like a daring Secretary of State. I mean, all these senior government officials, you know. They like to pretend that somehow, I'll never forget, I was at a speech that was given at the NYPD Intelligence Division. It was broader than that, though. There are people invited from all the different agencies. And some sort of policy academic guy showed up and told the harrowing tales of, you know, the sort of corkscrew flight into Baghdad to avoid, you know, it was terrifying. And I was sitting next to a three-tour Army Ranger, who was a friend of mine who was working with me. We were working, you know, together at the time, you know, right next to each other in the office, and we're sitting next to each other at this event. And I just remember looking at him. He was like, oh, yeah, that corkscrew flight. So dangerous, bro. And this is a guy who had, you know, been clearing houses in Fallujah, and he's sitting here, and he's hearing his policy official talk about, oh, yeah, you know, that flight, I had real motion sickness on it. So this is a common enough thing among many senior – because you start to, after a while, ask the question, like, wait – well, Hillary Clinton, these are the people that are making the decisions for special forces, for diplomats all around the world, for our operators, for those in the intelligence community. These are the people. You know, their biggest risk is what they wear to the fancy cocktail party in Georgetown. It starts to make you ask some questions. So anyway, but Hillary lies and nobody cares. Now we're told that it's a big deal that Donald Trump lied on this issue. And, you know, you could say he misremembered, but I think he's wrong. I think it would be relatively easy to prove. And again, if you think I'm wrong on this, let me know. But I think he's wrong on this one. Ben Carson's already walked it back, so there's that. But politicians lie all the time. And politicians that have been in power for years continue to lie. Barack Obama lies. He lies about stuff. Hillary Clinton lies as though it's really her first language. It's ahead of English for her, just lying in some capacity, whether it's written or spoken, or lying is what she does. But we'll have to. Here we have the Washington Post. Here's why Donald Trump's lies don't matter. He's strong. And it goes into some analysis of all this. and says, look at this. Isn't this amazing that he could be rising in the polls even when he's caught in lies? You're going to have Hillary Clinton supporters writing this kind of stuff?
Oh, it's astonishing that there could be a situation where somebody could lie and they would still have political support.
You're going to vote for Hillary. You're going to say that with a straight face? Such a lack of self-awareness in the media. It's pretty amazing when you give it some thought. All right, team. Much more coming up. Back in just a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Discover more at theblaze.com/radio.
The Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
And team, I've told you before that it's hard to keep up with the latest fads and fashions of the tyrannical left. They'll decide that something is just not okay, and you're supposed to know it's not okay, and if you don't realize that, well, they're coming after you. I initially saw this, and I thought to myself, this can't be true. And then I had to sort of chide myself. I had to sort of, you know, I felt foolish because, of course, it could be true. This courtesy of the Federalist, although it's appeared on a number of news sites. The University of Ottawa has suspended free yoga classes for disabled students due to cultural appropriation concerns. Let's talk about this for a second, shall we? I had been under the impression for some time that one of the things we were supposed to be so excited about when it came to diversity was that there would be all these other interesting cultural attributes that would be brought into our society. And so, you know, the best example of this is like ethnic food, right? And people would say, oh, that's such a imperialist thing to say. But I'm just saying, you know, what do you get from different cultures coming in? Living together, you know, you get some interesting fashion choices. You get some different food and, you know, some other stuff, music. And we're supposed to like all that stuff. But now because of cultural appropriation, oh, that is the unjust taking of a cultural issue or icon or practice. And, of course, you ask yourself immediately the question, well, who gets to determine what is an okay appropriation? We've seen this before. Is a sombrero on my head a celebration of Mexican culture, or is it a defamation of Mexican culture? I guess it depends on how angry they feel like getting at me that day. They being the left. It's not really clear. They get to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner on this. They just get to decide. In this case, you've got a young woman who's teaching free of charge, and she's been doing it since 2008. She's been teaching 60 students a basic yoga class, but the university has decided to cancel it because yoga, quote, stems from those who have experienced oppression, cultural genocide, and diasporas due to colonialism and Western supremacy. We need to be mindful of this and how we express ourselves while practicing yoga. What? Keep in mind that this woman who's teaching this class, Jennifer Scharf, she even said that she would rename it Mindful Stretching instead of yoga. Yeah, look, I'm not going to lie to you guys. I've done a little yoga. I'm not particularly good at it. I kind of sweat like somebody who's, you know, I'm about to have some sort of an episode where they pass out. But yeah, I've done yoga. Sure. And it can be nice, you know, to loosen up the various parts of the body that get tense and tight from life. But it certainly wasn't a spiritual experience for me. It was just do this stretch, now do this stretch, and me going, ow, ow, ow. But that's what it was. So why this would be considered in any way a nasty appropriation of culture, where does this stop, by the way? I'm just wondering, you know, when are they going to come for my gingham? Which, by the way, is a Malay word. It's from Malaysia. Gingham pattern comes from Malaysia. A legacy of colonialism, I will have you know. When will they come for my seersucker? A Hindu word, Shir Shakur, also a legacy of British colonialism. When will they come for these things, I ask you? When will they come for my Madras shorts? That funky pattern you'll see sometimes. Also, a legacy of British colonialism. That's when they go too far. You can talk a lot of smack as a leftist. You can get away with a whole bunch of things. But when you start coming after a preppy guy's seersucker pants and jacket, that means war, my friends. But I don't see why you couldn't make that same argument. That those the styles of dress, which were, yes, appropriated, taken by the British. Seersucker, as I said, the Hindu word, Shirshakur, it's a South Asian crushed cotton. And the gingham pattern, which is now like every shirt you see, at least on the East Coast, is pretty much gingham or some variant thereof these days. That comes from Malaysia. It became popular for tablecloths for a while, and so it wasn't using clothing quite as much, but now it's made a roaring comeback. But that's an appropriation. And we could go all day, by the way. The tie, which was popularized in Paris by the French, it actually comes from Croatian mercenaries, a cravati, and this became the cravat. It was based on a piece of cloth that they wrapped around their neck. It was sort of one of the distinguishing features of these mercenaries. I believe it was under Louis XIV. So, I mean, if Croatia gets all upset about this, I don't know what we're going to do. I mean, we can go on and on and on all day on this. Of course, cultures take things from other cultures. And if they take them and celebrate them and want to use them, this is called civilization. But these idiots on the left in Canada and the U.S. are so hypersensitive and so desperate to find yet another instance of victimhood where no one is victimized, yet another moment for them to stand tall and proud and browbeat people for doing nothing wrong so that they themselves can feel better. They can feel like they're the courageous fighter for the underdog. You can get rid of yoga? I mean, what is next? What is the world coming to? I'm not going to tell you that doing my salutations to the sun is my favorite thing, and I'm not a particularly adept yogi, but I'd like the option if I wanted to try. Back in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Dispensing the truth. This is Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team Buck, I think it's worth breaking down the various ways that we could defeat the Islamic State. I think you could look at this as several levels, or there are several levels on this battlefield. There is the ideological, there is the diplomatic, there's the economic, and there's the military. And I think looking at the various those different segments of this fight would give us a better sense of where all this is going. Ideologically, I have to say, it is still very troubling to me that here we are in the aftermath of what has been 2015, a year of major terrorist attacks in places around the world. And yet you'll still hear in the conversation, you'll still hear people discussing the Islamic State, to borrow from President Obama, as though it is neither Islamic nor a state. And you'll read these articles, and there have been some very good ones, some very interesting ones, that go in some depth and detail about why it is that young people from the UK, from France, from America, from anywhere really in the world that there are Muslim populations would decide to defy the laws of their home country, risk long-term imprisonment, risk death and dismemberment by actually joining the fight with the Islamic State, would perhaps be willing to sign up as suicide bombers. You get into the why. And very quickly, it has to be understood that this is ideological. People are not going to fight for the Islamic State because it will make them rich. They are not going to fight for the Islamic State because they are so oppressed in their home country, because they are so desperate, because there's no future for them. Sure, there are some frustrations, and in an effort to identify root causes, you will see individuals. You will see individuals write about this in such a way that it seems like, well, these disaffected youths are going to join the Islamic State because, well, they're disaffected. And they will avoid getting into a theological discussion or theological analysis of what is it within Islam that presents itself in such a way that there could be so many. And we are not talking about two or three, which is why it is distinct from problems that the left will raise, such as, oh, well, what about a tie between white supremacists and certain churches? Or what about Tamil Tigers using suicide bombers in Sri Lanka? Or what about Buddhists in Southeast Asia who are engaged in violence? There's a difference here. And the difference is that we're talking about a very large number right now of those who will adhere to this ideology, specifically of the jihadist, the global jihadist ideology, not just of ISIS, but of Al-Qaeda and all of the other assorted jihadist terrorist organizations all over the world. Whether we're talking about, yes, Hamas or Jamaat Islamiyah or you name it, various groups in Pakistan, some are more sort of ethno-sectarian nationalists than they are necessarily global jihadists, but that all depends on which one we're talking about. But they all share something. They share some very basic but very profound beliefs, beliefs in the supremacy of Islam. They are Islamic supremacists. This is something that's not often talked about, but it is true. Islam considers itself to be the last and final word of God on earth. There can be no other religion. There's no other prophecy. And if you do a, not even a close reading, even a pretty cursory reading of the Quran, you will see repeated time and time again that the other people of the book, even Jews and Christians, they don't have the full story. The full story is Islam, which also, by the way, always raises questions for me. When we're told that we have to tolerate other religions, we can tolerate the practice of our fellow citizens' religions, but we don't have to celebrate other people's religions. That's a different step. And we don't have to pretend that we think that those religions are true either and respect the demands for obedience from those religions. See, Islam is distinct in this manner, and this is not just the Islamic State now. The Islamic State is just the most virulent manifestation of this. Islam is distinct in that it demands obedience even from non-believers, that it thinks that its rules about blasphemy, for example, apply to everyone and anyone, because ultimately the entire world is Islam. That's part of how you get people showing up to fight with the Islamic State. And they believe that it is just a matter of time before there is only one religion, and that religion is Islam. So they are Islamic supremacists. And also, by the way, in that same manner, they are colonialists. They are trying to colonize various parts of the world with this Islamic ideology, with this belief in jihad and Islamism. If you are a Brit and you show up in Syria and you're trying to expand Syrian control, I'm sorry, ISIS control of parts of Syria or Iraq or anywhere else for that matter, you're engaged in a colonizing venture. You are a colonialist. That is a colony now for you. You are seizing this as your property based on belief, not based on generations of who's been raised there and who has an attachment to the land. It's none of that. It's just your right. Because a book says you're right, or a series of additional commentaries, the Hadith says that you're right, or whatever the case may be. So one of the very first steps in dealing with the Islamic State and dealing with ISIS is to have some clarity on what we're dealing with here, where this comes from, what the beliefs are. I should put this even more bluntly. What are the bad ideas within Islam that lead to outcomes like the Islamic State? What are the bad ideas that have broad spectrum support in countries all over the world with Muslim communities. Doesn't necessarily mean majority support, but it's enough support that these ideas have to be taken very seriously. And in some cases, they are implemented as policies of the state. When you look at places like Pakistan and Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia, and there are others as well, Islamic law, the Sharia, is in varying ways, but is more or less put into practice. Certainly when it comes to laws about blasphemy and laws about discussing and criticizing this belief system, that seems to be the greatest point of sensitivity, by the way, which I think tells us a lot. And that's why discussing Islam honestly and truthfully and what's going on inside this community, even as a non-Muslim, I would put it to the other side that even as a non-Muslim, you are forced to talk about this and you are allowed to have an opinion on this because it affects you. They make it affect you. They don't seek to leave you alone. You can't just ignore this. It is a problem for all of us, believer and non-believer alike. You don't get to say, I'm just going to draw a cartoon here, but I'm a non-believer anyway. I'm a kafir, as they say. I'm an infidel, so what difference does it make? Oh, no, they'll come for you, too. So if I have to live under that reality, which, by the way, you'll hear people point out that, oh, that's such a small minority, and yet it's always there. And it's not uprooted. They haven't been able to come up with a way. There's no antidote offered to this very aggressive anti-free speech sentiment within Islam. And this is true in many countries within the Islamic world. This is not a random thing here or there. This is not to the extremes. They'll always say this, oh, ISIS, you're just talking about ISIS. That's not true. If you walk around and you criticize the Prophet Muhammad, in a lot of places you'll be stoned, you'll be attacked, you'll be killed, and the state will either turn a blind eye to it or involve itself in it. So this is really the very first step, is we have to come to grips with the fact that there is a faith tradition that does not believe in free inquiry. In large measure, I'm sure that you could say, oh, well, look at what you could discuss this in Turkey, or you could discuss this in some other Muslim country that's relatively speaking moderate, although Turkey is becoming less moderate all the time, by the way. But you'd say to yourself, well, is that enough? Is that the same standard that would be applied to the other side? Why is it, for example, that we're constantly reminded that there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world, and therefore, even if there are, call it 15,000 acts of terrorism, jihadist Islamist terrorism, year in and year out, maybe it's more, maybe it's less, but that's a rough number based on the State Department estimates. Even if that's the case, well, there are more Christians than there are Muslims, and how many acts of Christian terrorism are there around the world? Let's do an apples-to-apples comparison there. Why is one faith tradition so much faster to draw its sword, so to speak, than the other? And you have to say, well, there must be something going on here, right? If it is, in fact, true at that macro level around the world that one religion is faster to resort to violence than another of comparable size, we should be allowed to ask why that is, which again brings us back to ideas that are prevalent within the Islamic faith. Prevalent does not mean everyone. It does not mean even dominant, but prevalent means enough that it's a real problem. It is consistent. And you can find it without looking very far. And if you can't confront those issues and you can't discuss them, how can you ever change them? So really, in many ways, the first step, if I could offer this to you, the first step in defeating the Islamic State is calling out what those ideas are that the Islamic State rests upon that are false, that are immoral, that are not true. And then look at where else has that strain, so to speak, of belief, where else has that infected the minds of people? How broad is it? It will require people being willing to stand up and say, no, I'm sorry. There can be no separation under law between the rights of men and the rights of women. There can be no state that considers itself just that would execute homosexuals for merely being homosexuals or homosexual activity. There can be no just state that would kill somebody for the choice to leave a religion or for speaking words that are deemed to be in opposition to a faith. There are no exceptions to this. These are universal truths. So ultimately, the first step in defeating the Islamic State and defeating radical Islam is being willing to stand up and say, no, no, we have universal truth on our side, and you have nothing but oppression and tyranny and death to offer to yours. Talk about diplomacy and maybe some economics in a second. I'll be right back.
Buck Sexton, dispensing the truth.
On the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
So on the level of diplomacy, what can be done to defeat the Islamic State? Well, you would need to have leadership from the one nation that's in a place that it could actually show leadership to a coalition of 60-plus countries, and that's America. This has been one of the areas in which we have been most lacking, or I should say where this administration has been most lacking. There must be a vision of what needs to be done. If you don't know what you are trying to do, you're definitely not going to accomplish anything worth doing in a situation like the Syrian civil war. Do we expect that Assad will be gone? Where is that on the list? When we say we will degrade and defeat ISIS, what will that mean? How far are we willing to go? What will that entail? The president has said there will be no ground troops. Well, now there are some ground troops, so he says there will not be that many ground troops. Why is he putting himself into these artificial constraints from the get-go? We see that there are French planes flying, British planes flying, some other countries fly the occasional sortie. But guess what? None of that is going to defeat the Islamic State. We know it can't be defeated from the air. So what would it require? It would require the United States sitting down with some of the allies, such as they are in the region, and saying, okay, what can you bring to the table? We really need you to do something here. Here's the problem, or perhaps here's the reason that the Obama administration has not done that. Their focus now, for the better part of Obama's second term, the focus has not been on stopping or mitigating or even really containing the civil war and jihad in Syria. That's not what the administration's been focused on. They have been focused on getting a deal done with Iran. They seem to think that that would be not just a legacy item for them, but also a means of quieting down the entire neighborhood, so to speak, all of the Middle East. Well, that's just not going to happen. It's not happening, as we see. So they mortgaged all of their credibility with allies. They mortgaged their credibility with Saudi Arabia and with others as well when it came to the seriousness of the ISIS fight, because that was never their top priority. That was never the top of the list. So diplomatically, what could we do? Well, what we could do, what we should have been doing from the start, which is bring allies to the table and convince them of the need, twist some arms if need be, that we need their help in this fight against the Islamic State in ways that will have an impact, not just, oh, sure, sign here so we can say this is what the number joining our coalition is. I mean, 60 countries? We've got about 55 countries that haven't done squat. So it's not leadership at all. It's just pretense. It's deferral. It's delay. So if we want to defeat the Islamic State diplomatically, it means having a vision. It means standing in defense of that vision, having principles that we will apply to the situation, bring our allies along, and some countries that are a bit hesitant saying, look, we're going to find you at our side one way or another here. Maybe we'll make a deal, or maybe we'll have to apply some pressure. That's what the administration should have done. They just haven't done it.
You're listening to Buck Sexton on the Blaze Radio Network. We'll be right back.
spreading freedom across the nation. This is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome back to the Freedom Hut. I wanted to continue our discussion and now get into how the Islamic State could be beaten militarily. Well, to help us work through that proposition, we have a perfect guest, Gary Burnson. He's a former CIA officer and best-selling author of Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, a personal account by the CIA's key field commander. Gary, thank you for calling in.
Pleasure to be with you, Buck.
So, Gary, if you would, please, walk us through, assuming that you were given, next week, you were given the task of taking back Raqqa, doing it with a sort of similar footprint and similar resources to what was done in Afghanistan. What would that entail if your objective was take back Raqqa and take back this territory from the Islamic State in Syria? How would you go about doing it alongside of military and intelligence personnel?
What I would say is that we need to recognize that there is a difference between the Islamic State, Raqqa, and what existed in Afghanistan in 2001. In 2001 in Afghanistan, the Taliban had 60 to 70,000 fighters, and they had an element of Al-Qaeda from between 3 and 5,000. We went in with a small footprint, using local militias and tribal folks and air power to defeat them. And we were able to drive them out of the country quickly. But the problem is not defeating Raqqa. It's going to be holding that ground afterwards. That's going to be the problem. We could go in right now, drop the 82nd Airborne in, or go in with the 101st, or line up armor, come in from Kuwait and do a massive drive-by shooting as we drive up through Iraq across the territory held by ISIS and, extract that armored element out of Lebanon. But the place would still be a nightmare because you've got a massive number of people that are in conflict there. We're going to need a force on the ground to hold. I drafted an article some time ago called In Support of Surrogate Forces. And what I really believe we need to do is we need to build what I would call a Freedom Corps, and we need Egyptians, Saudis, Afghans, Bangladeshis, all in an organization that looks like the French Foreign Legion led by the U.S., and put those guys on the ground so that you don't have Westerners holding the ground. Maybe you have officers doing that, but that would be the force that holds afterwards. So I would say start with CIA and special operations, work with locals to attack them, but you're going to have to come in with a force, and no one in the area wants to be the one that holds the ground. You don't see Saudi or the Egyptians or anyone else. No one wants to be that force that goes in, and defeating ISIS will not be difficult. Holding the ground will be the expensive part of this.
Now, would you say then that would require a shift? Because it seems as though the administration's obviously failed policy in this regard, and I don't think even the most stalwart defenders of the administration would disagree on this point. They failed to train the forces that at least ostensibly would have been used to take back territory. It sounds like what you're saying is there could be a shift whereby you train the occupation forces, so to speak. You train the security forces that would take that would fill in the vacuum. But we could still, using special operations, as you said, 82nd Airborne and other elements, we could be the hammer to smash ISIS. But we need to have something in place to fill that vacuum, to fill that gap afterwards. That would be certainly a shift in strategy for the administration. How long do you think that would take to put together, Gary? I mean, how these things go. You know what the lags can be.
Yeah. Well, the problem is the Obama administration is starting from zero. I mean, this, in geopolitical terms, the president is a dunce. I mean, it is just hard to believe. And I say that only because of the unbelievable violence visited on the people of segments of Iraq and Syria. And the president takes responsibility for that. He withdrew preemptively. This violence is of his making. And his actions and his policies, he doesn't even have a policy on this, have been to kick the can down the road. So, we could put a U.S. force on the ground there and drive, we could defeat these people in the Islamic State in a period of 60 days. I have no doubt we could defeat them in 60 to 90 days if we put a serious force of 30, 40, 50,000 people on the ground. But the thing that we have to get to business on very, very quickly is assembling the force, a Sunni force to hold Sunni territory. What we do not want to do is we do not want to have a situation where you have a Shia Iraq, Shia Iran, Shia slash Alawite force in Syria and the Shia Hezbollah dominating this area and conducting a genocide against the Sunnis that are on the ground that would be defenseless at that point. And they will come in. The problem is that this is all has to be managed in the context of a massive sectarian fight. And that fight is driven by Iran and its new regional allies, to include the Russians, who are attempting to depopulate Sunni areas right now. This is a bigger mess than we have ever seen in the Middle East, at least in the past 50 years since World War II. It falls in the lap of President Obama and those incompetent fools at the National Security Council. I just can't fathom the suffering that has taken place because of these nincompoops and the president's inability to comprehend what's going on. He needs to start over, and sadly, it's too late for the people of the Middle East. The suffering, the death of their children and their families and everything like that is all courtesy of Barack Hussein Obama.
One of the big stumbling blocks, Gary, whenever there's a discussion about what could be done now is, well, what would be done, even assuming, let's say, literally the president put you in charge and we landed military elements. They pushed on Raqqa. They kicked out the Islamic State. We had a sort of ongoing training of forces to take over. If we got beyond that for just a moment for the purposes of our discussion.
Right.
What about Assad? Where does he fit in? I mean, I know that in Afghanistan there are some unsavory characters that still had power even after the Taliban left. Assad seems to be at a sort of a whole other level, using chemical weapons on his own people. But what of Assad? Do we have to deal with the reality where Assad maybe maintains power and has at least control of some part of the country? Where do you fall on that?
I would say first we have to drive out ISIS. Once ISIS is driven out, we drive out Assad second. But he has to go. He's a genocidal murderer, and he will have to go at some point. But my primary concern is ISIS, since they are attacking the United States and our Western allies. But I would deal with Assad secondarily.
You deal with Assad second. So I also wanted to move our attention for a moment to what's going on in Europe and counterterrorism efforts there. If I put you in a room with the various countries that have been, over the past year, affected. I mean, France obviously is the one that comes to mind most immediately because of mass casualty attack there, more than one mass casualty attack, as we know. But if I had you sit down with the leaders of the top security services of, you know, Germany, France, the UK, and a few others, what would you tell them they need to do if they're going to keep their people safe against ISIS coming into 2016?
First off, they have to know who's in their country. That's the problem we have in the United States because we have an open border. But their problem is worse. We know that there are thousands of individuals, many more thousands, that have traveled from Europe down to Raqqa or even earlier into the Afghan PAC area that have been trained and are back. You're going to have to know who's there. You're going to have to biometrically, you know, be checking all of these people. You cannot have large public gatherings without heavy security. I mean, Europe is now Israel. Because among it are, and it's Israel not at this point, but Israel 20 years ago, where in its midst were many, many people that wished the population harm and that had the capacity to do so. And, you know, there were times in Israel where they would have, you know, 20, 30 bombings in a period of 2 months or 3 months. You could see Europe in a position like that because these people, you know, don't care if they get caught. They'll fight to the end. They'll die. They consider themselves mujahideen. And they're committed Salafists. So the Europeans have made their bed. And they have the problem that they have is that they have to control their borders. The European Union and the Schengen Agreement was set up sort of this gigantic experiment with open borders. But people are pouring in from the south. And as the sectarian war between Shia and Sunnis intensifies over the next few years, we could have a larger number of refugees coming into Europe in the next 2 years than we've seen this year. This can get worse, Buck. It can get much worse.
Do you think that the European leadership has really registered the gravity of the situation? I mean, you still have Angela Merkel saying, no, no, we're going to keep taking in a very large number of refugees. It'll be close to 1 million this year. But as also sort of a corollary to that, as an addition to that, do you think that there's a recognition that culture matters and that the Europeans...
Let me tell you a quick story. A friend of mine who spent a lot of time in Kurdistan was telling me that along the Kurdish border where ISIS was lined up against them, that they noted there were about 20 different young ISIS commanders that were leading the equivalent of platoons against them. And been fighting them for the last year and a half, and all of a sudden, about 3 months ago, they disappeared. And so new commanders came in. And their question is, where did these young commanders that have been fighting us go? And their response is that they believe that they have taken them off the battlefield and they have run them into the refugees that they pushed up into Europe. So hang on to your hat.
So you firmly believe, based on people you talk to, that whether or not, because there's been this debate as to whether the major attacks in Paris were directly tied to the refugee flow. It seems that in at least one case, one of the attackers was, but there's still this hesitancy to draw that conclusion.
Right. No, look, many of those people, of course, that participated in the attacks were people that were born and raised in and understood European society and could move through the human terrain. But you will see waves of attacks. You'll see additional attacks in the future that will be from individuals that came as refugees. There were individuals captured by the Italians. There was an individual, a senior ISIS guy was captured by the Italians in a boat 2 weeks ago. They're coming. And remember, and this is what Americans just seem to fail, and Europeans fail to recognize. We are actually at war with these. We're bombing these guys every day, and they have no other way to respond to us than to do this. This will be their response. If you're a real people, expect them to attack you.
One last question before we have to break. What, in your mind, is the likelihood that there's going to be a major contingent of U.S. troops, when I say major, in the low thousands within the next 12 to 18 months? Deployed to Syria and Iraq.
I think that we're going to have to take responsibility to participate in an effort to destroy ISIS. I think that there will be. It needs to be a large coalition. We need to bring the Saudis and the Egyptians and the rest of them with us. We have to build a force that will occupy, that will not include Westerners. And then we need to think about how do we protect the Sunnis in a place like Anbar province, where you have a Shia government in Iraq now that is hostile to them. Do essentially maybe what we need to do is redraw the borders. Maybe Jordan should expand into Anbar province. The Hashemites controlled that territory 100 years ago. Maybe they should again. Maybe they should be under the protection of another group of Sunnis, because I don't believe you can trust the Iraqi Shia government to do that. So there's going to have to be lines redrawn in the Middle East.
I was going to say, redrawing some lines on the map. We're at that point. Yeah. We're basically a do-over with the Obama administration and maybe looking at redrawing some lines on the map. Gary Burnson, former CIA officer, author of Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, a book that I have read. I recommend highly to all of you. Gary, great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Great pleasure.
All right, team, more coming up. We'll be back in just a minute.
Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network. You're listening to The Buck Sexton Show, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Team, I mentioned taking warfare to the Islamic State, or taking the fight to the Islamic State in an economic sense as well. That has been something that's been underway for some time, not entirely successfully, but not entirely without success either. Oil revenue for ISIS is down by about a third because of strikes. There have also been continuous efforts to try to keep them out of the global financial system, which have not been, again, entirely successful, but they are largely successful. But they are operating what is predominantly a cash economy. They're moving a lot of oil on the black market. They move in tankers. They're not using more advanced infrastructure than that. And so by taking out some of that infrastructure, we are choking off funds to the Islamic State. But remember, if it is a state, it has to have money to pay salaries. It has to be able to pay for its Sharia courts and buy weapons. And so there is a financial and an economic angle to our struggle against them as well. And certainly hitting the oil infrastructure is a critical component of that. The estimates are that it was earning about $47 million a month from oil sales before October. So that's gives you a sense of that's their main revenue source. Now, they also have protection rackets, in a sense, operating. It's really like a mafia state. There are businesses that have to pay a tax. There are businesses that have to pay some percentage of whatever it is that they are selling or whatever commerce they're engaged in that falls under this umbrella of Islamic State control. They have to pay that money to ISIS. There was also, for a time, the kidnapping operations that ISIS was running. But as we know, those are harder to come by now for the Islamic State, because we saw that the Islamic State was executing Western captives. So there are far fewer Westerners or internationals who are putting themselves in that sort of level of harm's way, because they understand that ISIS will grab them and will threaten to behead them if they don't get money, and they will behead them if they don't get the money. So kidnapping has been a means of ISIS raising funds. But choking off money to this group is a very important step. I think we will find out more in the future about just how much financial support under the table ISIS has received from wealthy donors in neighboring Sunni Arab states, essentially suitcases full of money arriving in the back of a pickup truck that makes its way to the central bank, if you will, of Raqqa. Not that there necessarily is an advanced banking system there, but they certainly have a place where they're stashing all the cash. And so these are the ways. And remember, they also seized Mosul and seized the assets of Mosul, including the Bank of Mosul. So they were flush with cash for a little while, but to sustain themselves over the longer term, that's going to be hard. So if we can keep them out of the banking system, which is an essential step, and I think that that's something that the U.S. Treasury Department, along with all of our allies, does a pretty good job of doing, that will make it a lot harder for them. And if we continue to hit the oil infrastructure, it should be pointed out that by hitting oil infrastructure, though, you are taking away the revenue sources for whatever the follow-on government would be, right? We were just talking to Gary a minute ago about how the occupation force is the force that has, in some ways, the greatest challenges here. It's not just smashing ISIS in Raqqa. It's rebuilding Raqqa. It's providing services. It's paying civil servants. It's paying a police force. And unless you want a situation like we have in Afghanistan, where largely the bills of that nation are paid out of the largesse of the international community, if you want a sort of self-sustaining Syria, alliteration, if you want a self-sustaining Syria, you're going to have to find yourself a means of gathering revenue or getting some cash for those who are going to have to pay those salaries and try to run that area. So the more we bomb, the more investment's going to have to come on the back end of all of this to try to rebuild the situation. That's not to say that we shouldn't be bombing the oil infrastructure. We certainly should. There also, of course, are those reports about oil trucks being driven on behalf of the Islamic State, and we release flyers saying, get out of the trucks, we're going to bomb you. It's interesting, trying to limit civilian casualties. But once you're separating out ISIS economic activities from overall ISIS activities, I think that's an interesting distinction that the Obama administration has made. All right, team, we're going to talk about how to defend ourselves here in the homeland from ISIS, which is also part of this war, in a minute.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Show.
Team, we've been talking about how we can win the war against ISIS on their home turf and what can be done to defeat plots against Europe. Now let's talk about how to secure the homeland against the Islamic State. Certainly part of the war against ISIS. They say they're going to bring this war to our doorstep. And if we don't beat them, and if we don't manage to take this threat seriously, it's only a matter of time before they hit us. To help us talk with us now, we're joined by our friend Dan Bongino. He's a contributing editor at Conservative Review, and he's the author of The Fight, A Secret Service Agent's Inside Account of Security Failings and the Political Machine, which will be available January 12th. Dan Bongino, great to have you call in. Thanks for your time.
Always good to be here, Buck. Thanks for having me.
All right, Dan. So we know the threat level is elevated. We know the State Department has put out this sort of broad, somewhat vague global warning for all U.S. citizens traveling abroad anywhere. So we know there's an elevated threat. If I were to put you at the head of DHS and the FBI, Dan, all right, we're going to create a sort of special czar for domestic security for the purposes of our conversation here. What steps do we take now? What do we do to make sure we don't get hit at home by the Islamic State?
Well, here's one of the ironies about the current ongoing national dialogue, so to say, about surveillance. Everybody's focusing so heavily on the metadata argument, the ability of the NSA to accumulate phone records, not necessarily content, but duration and number dialed. And we've lost sight of, in my opinion, Buck, what the real argument should be and what the real dialogue should be about. And that's our actual old-fashioned physical surveillance capabilities. You know, during my time with the Secret Service working, one specific case that started as a financial crimes case and wound up spinning into a counter-terror operation with the local FBI office, we were so limited in our physical surveillance capabilities because of the manpower required that just due to simple math, the time, you know, hours in the day, the chronology, there was no way to possibly surveil these people all the time. One of the growing, I think, the scandals you're going to hear about is how limited we are at the federal level to actually conduct surveillance. We've relied so heavily on heavily on the metadata component that we've lost the old-fashioned, so-called boots-on-the-ground approach.
So what do you think should be done about that?
Well, unfortunately, the guns and butter argument was lost a long time ago with the Obama administration. It's clearly been a butter approach, and that's it. I mean, we've pretty much gutted our military infrastructure, our federal law enforcement infrastructure, our intelligence infrastructure, although he'll argue otherwise. We all know that's the case. I mean, think about what's happening in New York, although not certainly a federal issue. The politics behind surveillance certainly apply on both, where the NYPD was prohibited from surveilling people in mosques. I mean,
I know all about that. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you work there. I mean, you and I both remember the NYPD.
They don't want us to pay close attention when somebody says, "Hey, I'm going to go pray, and who can help me get an AK-47 because I want to go shoot up a synagogue somewhere." That apparently that's unfair profiling according to the critics of the NYPD. But anyway,
I mean, Buck, that's an absurd, you know, it's outrageous. I mean, think about it. If that was a Christian church or claiming to be Christian church, I mean, no real Christian would do that, but someone claiming to be Christian, frankly, like some of these people claim to be Muslim, and in the church they were openly advocating for the overthrow of the United States, you and I both know the Bureau would be in there tomorrow morning with the NYPD counterterror team, and there'd be people out there in those plastic handcuffs. I mean, that's just the way it works. This is only political because President Obama cannot seem to get past this infatuation with not calling out radical Islam what it is. And you know, he's in love with the straw man. And I'm frankly tired of the straw man. Listen, Buck, neither you nor I nor any other, you know, common sense American is saying every Muslim's involved in terrorism. That's absurd. That's ridiculous. It's stupid. You know, I'm Italian. They did this with the Italians back in the day where, oh, you're Italian? Well, you must be part of the mob. You know, you want to backhand someone when they say that. We don't do that in the United States. There are a couple idiots here and there, but overall we're a very accepting culture. But the fact that there are a group of terrorists who are openly invoking Islam doesn't mean that it has nothing to do with it either. And that's the problem ideologically this president has and why he's not serious about combating the threat.
Now, I think when we look at the soft underbelly of Europe when it comes to terrorism, it's really twofold. On the one hand, it is disaffected recent immigrants or disaffected second-generation immigrants who come primarily from North Africa and parts of the Middle East. who attack the French state, who attack French citizens or German citizens or wherever under the banner of jihad. But there's also, of course, this huge surge of migrants, which brings up in an immediate near term sense the question of border security. Now, there have been some Syrians who we were told were just trying to become refugees who were picked up, I believe it was in Honduras, and they were on their way into the United States. We know they're going to try to come via the southern border. Do you think that right now it's likely that there are plots the Islamic State is considering or is even operational on where they would try to penetrate via the southern border? And can we do anything about that?
Of course, I've listened. That's a given. That very rarely in life is anything 100%. You ask 100 kids if they want homework, you know, one kid's always going to raise his hand and say yes. With 100% certainty, I can tell you that the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, AQAP, probably Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, you name the group, up and down the Maghreb, the Levant, whatever you choose to call it, there are groups saying to themselves right now, how do we slip people in as Syrian refugees to conduct small arms tactical assaults in the United States? Folks, that's 100% certain. Now, Buck, if you think this vetting process, which I know you don't, but if your listeners, I know you have listeners on the left, and that's great, appreciate you listening. But if you think this vetting process is thorough, let me ask you a very simple question, okay? The Secret Service goes to Nelson Mandela's funeral, right? Now, I was an agent. These guys did the best job they could possibly do. When you go overseas and you bring the president overseas, you are relying on the foreign government's database to vet people. End of story. You don't go over there and do a DMV check. It just doesn't work that way. You're relying on foreign intel. President Obama goes to Nelson Mandela's funeral. A guy stands behind him, a sign language interpreter, who had a criminal record and clearly had never been vetted. This was with the full resources of the United States Secret Service, the government, and the South African government at the most high-profile funeral the country's probably ever had, and the guy still got within a couple feet of the president. Are you laughingly, sadly, tragically telling me that that very same vetting process by foreign governments and us is going to weed out the Syrian terrorists trying to insert themselves into the refugee crowd? Give me a break, please. You know what? You almost want to slip an expletive in there to show you how much danger the people who are proposing this are putting us in right now.
Dan, what are you hearing from friends who are still on the inside at Secret Service? And I know you have friends at FBI and other federal law enforcement agencies. What are you hearing from them about their sense of this current threat stream right now against the United States coming from ISIS, coming from any jihadist entity, Al-Qaeda, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra, any of them? Are they particularly concerned? Because I know a lot of people out there are really concerned right now.
Well, one guy I talked to specifically is horrified at what's going on. He's a friend of mine. He was saying that when they go out and they interview anyone that has to do with Islam, the religion, that when they go out and interview people, there's like a ream of paperwork to do to make sure it's not some kind of a profiling case, no matter how hard the information is from the start. This is the kind of thing that sets a tone in an agency. You know, at some point, Buck, we have to trust our FBI agents that have sworn to protect that they're going to do the right thing, and if they don't, we have to set strict penalties. Listen, I'm a libertarian at heart. We don't want to give people unchecked powers. But we have to assume at some point that if we're hiring the best people and they're out there just randomly profiling Muslims, that there'll be a complaint process and those people will be terminated. You can't set up, though, this system where, forget about screaming fire in a movie theater. Before people go into movie theater, we're asking them if they're going to scream fire. In other words, we're doing this preemptive thing, putting the handcuffs on our intelligence agents and our law enforcement at home preemptively before they even go out to send a message that, hey, listen, you screw this up, and there's even an allegation here potentially of profiling on that end, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. The guys are terrified. You know, they're saying to themselves, listen, we're just getting these threats from sources, and we're going out where there's people looking over our shoulder at every opportunity. I mean, again, I'm a libertarian at heart. I'm not for unchecked power. But this administration has clearly sent the message from the top that this is some kind of a criminal poverty problem, terrorism, that needs to be understood rather than a problem of animalistic, hegemonic savages that want to kill us who need to be terminated. There's a big difference.
Dan, it sounds like you agree with me then, and I've been saying this here at The Blaze and also elsewhere, that the administration, you do get a real sense from this administration that they believe the greater threat, the greatest threat, is not of a mass casualty attack on the homeland at the hands of jihadists, whether it's ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or anyone else, but that essentially diversity will be a casualty of all this, that the backlash that, as you put it out, by the way, and I've said this before, too, the backlash that never comes, because that's not who we are, and none of us would support this backlash, and we would stop this backlash. But it seems like the administration thinks this imaginary backlash against the Muslim community in this country is really the biggest threat we face. And that's very unnerving for those of us who are worried about a subway getting blown up or a mall being shot up.
Right. I mean, we're parents, you know, we're brothers, we're sisters, we're fathers, mothers, grandparents. I don't want my kids in a shopping mall, you know, on Black Friday, looking down the business end of the barrel of a Kalashnikov, okay? This is not an irrational thing, Buck. It's happening. And the fact that the Obama administration, you know, views the genesis of terrorism overseas as the problem of a capitalistic income inequality system that's oppressed people, and this is somehow their natural, you know, they're emoting here through death and destruction, is nonsense. Some of these terrorists we saw from Bin Laden, Zawahiri. These were educated people, many members of the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood, Buck. You know, Bin Laden's family was one of the wealthiest in that region of the world. This is not a function of your income inequality pseudo-argument. It's a function of a perverse ideology that's taken a branch of a religion, which they've invoked, and have used it to brutally slay people in cold blood and torture them. If you don't understand that and you view this as some battle versus capitalism and the United States is the great imperialist, the fight will never be won because the fight will never start. It'll be a bunch of excuses as to why they're doing it. And you saw it with John Kerry, who unbelievably tried to use the word legitimate with the Charlie Hebdo attack. I mean, that wasn't a story in The Onion. He really said that. This is embarrassing.
Dan Bongino is a contributing editor at Conservative Review. He's the author of The Fight, a Secret Service Agent's Inside Account of Security Failings and the Political Machine, available January 12th. Is there a pre-order for that on Amazon, Dan?
Yes, sir, there is. We're doing really well on pre-orders. Thank you for mentioning
Excellent.
That.
Excellent. Well, we'll make a fantastic digital stocking stuffer for anybody, I am sure. Dan Bongino, thank you so much, Dan. Great to talk to you. I appreciate your time.
Yes, sir, anytime. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, team, well, that's at least one discussion, one roadmap, one strategy, one way forward for how we could defeat the Islamic State. It is possible. It would have to take a multi-pronged approach. It would have to be done with seriousness and with resolve. It would really require a do-over from this administration, and I'm not sure we would get that. But it is possible to beat ISIS. We can do this. We just have to figure out what we're going to do and then go for it. Back in a minute.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network. This is the Buck Sexton Show.
Team, I know we've talked a lot about national security today. I've got breaking news for you, and it is not good news. Hostages, according to Reuters, hostages have been taken in northern France, a town called Roubaix, which is right on the border with Belgium. This is what we know right now. An operation is underway after hostages were taken. Gunshots were fired, and the neighborhood has been cordoned off. A bank director and his family may have been taken as hostages. So this right now, we have obviously it's very early in all this. We don't have any real additional reporting to cite here, except there are gunmen who have taken hostages in a border town between France and Belgium, which if we're going to go with our, whether you're somebody who's jumping to conclusions or you're becoming a coincidence theorist, if this was not in any way related to the jihadist terror cells active in France and Belgium in recent days, that would seem to be an extreme coincidence, which makes me think that obviously, and I know your mind's already gone there, this could very well be tied into all of that, but we don't have any additional information other than a hostage situation and an entire neighborhood is cordoned off. And that's what we know. So this is going to be the future, I think, in Europe for some time. You're going to see more of these kinds of attacks. whether this involves jihadists or not doesn't change the overall narrative and the overall trajectory of what we can expect in that part of the world. The Europeans had really thought for some time, they had really taken in this idea that culture, people will either join your culture or not. And if they don't, that's okay, because diversity became this explanation for everything and all things. In fact, diversity became a term you could use to shout down those who disagree with you. Diversity went from a rallying cry rooted in goodwill to a term used to bludgeon others into submission. You know, you better support this, you better believe in this, or else. And there's going to be a lot of soul searching in Europe, I believe, at least in some quarters, in the months ahead. I don't have more for you right now on this hostage situation. I will watch this closely. I'll be sending out updates on Facebook.com/BuckSexton and on Twitter as I see them. We can continue the conversation on those platforms throughout the afternoon and into tonight. I will be here with you live tomorrow in the Freedom Hut, taking up whatever's in the news cycle. And we'll also have some time to just talk about Thanksgiving and family. As always, team, it is a great pleasure to have you here with me. Cheers, Tom.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.